Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another live episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you enjoy the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, we're joined by John Wessling and J.D. Hall from Greenspring Associates, a $13 billion venture capital firm, for a conversation on VC investing. John, J.D., welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Peter.
Yeah, of course. And perhaps maybe to start off, you guys can tell the audience a little bit about who Greenspring is. And I know you all have some exciting news on that front as well about the future of Greenspring.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks a lot, Peter. Yeah, Greenspring has a pretty interesting origin story. We were founded 21 years ago as a pretty entrepreneurial company, not too dissimilar from Yield Street. A couple folks in their mid to late 20s ruminating on an idea about building a venture capital platform. So what made Greenspring pretty unique from day one was not only investing in venture capital funds, which is commonly referred to as a fund of funds, but also knowing and realizing that venture capital fund investments could create some interesting opportunities to pursue direct investments in companies using the information derived from the fund investments and the relationships that Greenspring forms with those fund managers, as well as looking into secondaries, which were a pretty nascent portion of the venture market back in the early 2000s, but basically situations where we're providing liquidity to founders of companies later in their life cycle or to limited partners in funds. And Peter, as you alluded to, it's a pretty exciting day. We're one day removed from announcing kind of the next chapter in Greenspring's history. We're joining StepStone Group, which is a global private markets firm that focuses on kind of the entire gamut of the alternative investment ecosystem. And we're really pleased to be basically joining as their venture capital and growth equity arm.
No, that's really exciting stuff. And you know, I want to talk a lot about, you know, what Greenspring's expertise is. And for the audience, you know, we're likely to use Greenspring and StepStone a little bit interchangeably. So please just, you know, bear with us on that front. Maybe, you know, you could just highlight how StepStone will help or what, you know, that ecosystem that's going to be created with Greenspring a part of it and what you all see as some of the benefits.
And secondaries investing. So for us to be able to partner with A, a global firm, B, a firm that specializes in private markets. So they're a group of investors. It's led by investors. It's led by people who speak the same languages as the historical VC folks at Greenspring. It's just really exciting. We can be more thrilled.
We're very happy for you all. So John, maybe you can kind of start, you know, for those that are a little bit less experienced with sort of VC investing and, you know, private equity fits along there as well when we think about, you know, a company's life cycle, but maybe focusing on the VC component, you can start, you know, by telling everyone, what is the traditional life cycle of a company almost from when it's ideated in someone's garage to eventually, you know, monetizing that asset?
Yeah, great question, Peter. So, you know, the venture journey is kind of different for every company, but typically, you know, an idea is born, some beta is developed, some early iteration of the product or service is developed. Many founders take the approach of, you know, if they're able to bootstrapping the business or putting up founder capital for a period of time, typically after that, founders look for institutional venture funding to create a syndicate to be supportive of that business going forward. Typically, that's referred to as a seed round. So typically very, very early product, very, very early service, oftentimes no revenue or a very minimal amount of revenue or low, you know, user metrics. eventually companies will look to raise a Series A. These days, it's typically a pretty healthy round size, maybe anywhere on the low end from 5 million upwards to 25, 30, 40 million these days. And that is kind of the early product round, the early service round, where there is some building revenue and some building momentum. Then at the Series B into this in the Series C, it's more of kind of an expansion stage financing round. There's some early revenue traction. Investors can start looking at the metrics of that business to understand cohorts of customers, to understand trends, to get a sense for how that business is heading. And it's more about scaling what has already been built. And from there, once you're in the D and beyond kind of phase, oftentimes you'll hear that referred to as pre-IPO, mezzanine, something in that vein. And increasingly, you're seeing non-traditional venture investors participate in that end of the market. You know, several years ago, you saw a lot of SoftBank. More recently, you're seeing a lot of Tiger Global and the Wellingtons, Fidelities, T. Rowe's of the world that have historically focused more on the public market side. And then eventually, you know, if the company really reaches a critical scale, an IPO can be in the cards. And there's a couple different ways to go public. Traditional way, a direct listing or a SPAC. But additionally, about 90% of venture-backed companies are exited via an M&A, typically to a strategic, sometimes to a financial buyer. And that journey can take anywhere from, you know, let's say at a minimum 6 or 7 years, upwards to 15 years. And the time of liquidity in the venture market is extending as companies have more availability of capital to stay private and as the public market demands more scale.
So a couple of follow-up questions on that. And JD, I don't know if you want to take this, but I guess, you know, how has venture capital investing sort of changed, let's say now versus pre-financial crisis versus let's say, 90s on two fronts, one of which you mentioned staying private for longer. And then also just sort of, you know, what some of the lessons learned have been over time versus those different eras.
So there's 2 points to the question. And I'm glad you brought up the financial crisis because it's important to think about venture through all market cycles, right? We're enjoying an incredible bull market right now, but we got to think about it in other contexts as well. To your first point, the dynamics have changed pretty dramatically in terms of the age that companies wait until they go public or you know, have some sort of liquidity event. 20 years ago, it was, I think, on average, 3 years to liquidity for venture-backed companies in the United States. Today, it's 8 or 9 years. Frankly, that's probably a little conservative. You know, we've seen some of the biggest listings this year, without getting into specific names, were companies that were upwards of 15 years old, you know, before going public. You know, on the flip side, when we think about venture funding in that private life cycle, which John did a really nice job of talking about just a second ago, we're looking at almost 7 rounds of funding pre-IPO. Now, I mean, there's a little bit of nuance there. It's not necessarily, you know, it's not necessarily A, B, C, D, E. There's pre-seed now, seed before you get to A. There's sort of A-B and different rounds along those lines. Without getting too much into the weeds, the short story is companies are simply staying private longer because, you know, they have more access to capital. They can invest in their businesses without necessarily tapping the public markets to do so. And so there's a lot of reasons why companies are staying private and staying private.
It's nice not to, you know, have the scrutiny of having to meet ongoing earnings each quarter. I think many founders like the ability to build a business for the longer term, as opposed to having public market investors really, really hone in on, you know, one quarter's numbers. It's interesting. We spent some time looking at the performance of founder-led companies that remained founder-led when they went public. And those companies outperform their peers, even when they were public, because I think it speaks to kind of the founder-driven mindset that is a part of the venture world and is a part of the private world that sometimes can kind of be stripped away as a public company because there's more short-termism, you know, that's around when quarterly numbers have to be hit on an ongoing basis.
So I'm curious, it's almost like purely from a selfish standpoint on behalf of the founders, you know, they're deferring, if anything, their sort of windfall or their liquidity event where they really, you know, get to see the fruits of all their labor. So I'm just curious, you know, is that a trade that most founders are willing to make, knowing that obviously, you know, there might be better earnings growth, for lack of a better term, or better overall growth of the business while staying private as opposed to accessing public markets?
You know, there are ways for founders to, you know, obtain liquidity one reason in one way or another, because as you say, you know, you can be worth a lot of money on paper, but, you know, not necessarily is that actually, you know, translating to your checking account. Founders can, you know, participate in secondary sales, for example, where they can generate some liquidity to, you know, buy a home, pay for their kids to go to school, you know, one thing or another. So there are paths for folks to do things out with just giving themselves a larger salary, but, you know, being responsible leaders of their businesses, there are ways for them to capitalize.
And to that point, what's become really interesting more recently is companies have stayed private longer, is the emergence of the secondary market. You know, the time horizon that LPs have, or investors in venture funds have, and venture fund managers themselves, 20 years ago, with exits being around 3 years, very reasonable period to be holding investments, you know, a liquidity cycle that was reasonable for the investors on the other side. Today, we found that having more options for interim liquidity along the way is really helpful for the entire sort of VC ecosystem. JD alluded to the founder side, but there's some pretty interesting things going on for the fund managers themselves as well. So, you know, one of the things that we do as an organization is help general partners of venture funds do restructurings of older funds so that their underlying investors can receive some liquidity as a fund gets older and there are fewer remaining assets in the portfolio. And it can be a really interesting win-win where the investors in that fund get liquidity. Greenspring or similar investors can walk into a portfolio where the assets are pretty mature and you can kind of pick out the exposure that you want to companies that are getting close to that M&A or IPO. And in venture, the better companies tend to be the ones that can continue to raise rounds for a long period of time. So it's created a really interesting dynamic that didn't exist 10, 20 years ago, where a whole new category in the venture world has opened up on the secondary side.
Yeah, you touched on a lot of points that I want to help unpack here, because I think these are a lot of the fruits of the conversation. But essentially, you know, we've talked so far about the life cycle of the underlying companies, right? But there's a lot of people who provide capital along the way who are looking for some form of return over time, right? That's generally speaking, you know, in the pre-IPO world, a large portion of where VC plays. So you mentioned a couple of things, one of which is direct investings, which, you know, I'm going to try to summarize, but please feel free to correct me. But essentially, a VC firm will pool capital and they will invest directly into companies in either the seed rounds or Series A through D, essentially pre-IPO. And we can talk about the post-IPO world as well. But then there's also those people who provided, you know, capital early stages who don't necessarily have the time horizons to wait another 3 or 4 years until a liquidity event and might seek to monetize those positions earlier, at which point someone, either a VC or other parties, can come in and actually monetize that event for them by taking their stake in that company before the IPO event. Is that generally a fair summarization?
Yeah, that's right. And we've seen that market grow pretty dramatically. You know, when we think about what you're describing are direct secondaries. In other words, secondary positions that can be taken directly onto the capitalization table of the company, right? And we've seen that market grow. It's right now, it's about $60 billion. You know, we think it's going to triple over the next few years. So certainly for groups who have the capital to put the work in secondaries, it's a really exciting place to play, because you're talking about accessing directly some of these unbelievable companies that we know have already sometimes in certain circumstances already taken over our lives in a good way. Or the companies of tomorrow that are going to be able to do so. And they happen to be just that much closer to liquidity. So for the investor, it's very appealing, you know, and as long as you're doing so, you know, investing, I should say, at the right valuation, you know, and even getting yourself a little bit of a discount because you're investing in the secondary, you know, it can be really fruitful. So it's very exciting.
It's also really fascinating because it's another way of getting exposure to great businesses. I think we often associate direct investing with money that actually goes onto the balance sheet of that particular business. In other words, capital that's being used historically for SG&A to assist in the company's sales and marketing efforts. When companies get to a certain scale, they may not need that primary capital to you know, continue to facilitate sales and marketing growth. It might be more appropriate, especially for a business that's cash flow break even, maybe even, you know, a little bit profitable, to, you know, look for secondaries as opposed to adding more capital on the balance sheet that may not necessarily be used in a way that results in good ROI.
And then I think, JD, you're about to hit on it, and I don't know if we cut you off, but also, so there's direct investing. And then also another way that you could play secondaries is by investing in previously launched funds, right? So you can other funds. Maybe you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's different ways to do it. And you know, 3/4 of venture capital funds in the United States go past 13 years. So if you put that in context, you, Peter, for example, as an investor in a venture capital fund, 13 years on, you can be getting a little antsy in terms of you've already made a very good multiple on your invested capital. So you've made good money. And you, frankly, you might be willing to just take your chips off the table and take a little bit of a haircut there. So for venture capital investors who do invest in secondaries, it can be really interesting to get access to a fund that may be a little bit later in its life. But because of those dynamics that we talked about 10 minutes ago with companies staying private longer, toward the end of that fund's life, if you will, you're left with some unbelievable value-driving assets that really are, you know, they're a huge portion of that fund's NAV, net asset value, but they still have room to run. You know, they've still got another 2x turn in them or 3x turn in them. So there's a lot, you know, it's not just the direct secondaries market that's exciting. These fund secondaries can be really interesting. And as John said, you know, what we're trying to do as venture capital investors at the end of the day is layer on our exposure to these winning companies. And if that happens to be from a direct investment or from a fund investment, frankly, we're agnostic as long as we're doing it at the right price and still are able to underwrite to a really healthy multiple.
No, that's great. I did want to touch on one other point, and I want to talk a little bit more about Greenspring and sort of how you all evaluate the market. But we talked about companies staying, you know, private for longer, and actually having, you know, at least over the last 3 years, a third source of kind of exit opportunities, which is via the SPAC. And obviously, you know, a big buzz around the SPAC market, you know, last year or so. Obviously, it feels like it's tapered off a little bit. Maybe you all can provide some color. But, you know, why have SPACs grown and become so popular as opposed to the traditional M&A or IPO exits?
Yeah, sure. Happy to chime in here. So, you know, I think SPACs are an interesting route to take for companies that are maybe not quite at a size and scale where a traditional IPO would be as viable, but are in spaces that are relatively well known, have brands that are relatively well known. And on the SPAC side, as I'm sure, you know, the majority of the viewers and listeners know, it's opened a pretty interesting market to a wider sort of aperture of investors, which I think has been pretty welcome for all participants included. So obviously there have been proposed changes, and there will be changes with respect to the way in which the SEC is monitoring, observing, and considering SPACs. So I think it's a category that everyone's going to have to kind of have a keen eye on as to what changes occur, but, you know, can be an interesting way for venture-backed companies to go the public route. Again, typically in more kind of consumer-oriented spaces, typically at a slightly earlier stage than maybe they would pursue a traditional IPO. And for us, selfishly, as folks that are trying to generate good returns for our limited partners, it's another exit avenue sort of at our disposal to generate liquidity and to hopefully create strong returns for our investors.
Do you think, you know, that the SPAC market right now, you know, would you say it's frothy? Would you say it's, you know, is there just a lot of dry capital or dry powder on the table where, you know, they're paying slight premiums in order to actually deploy some of that capital? Or do you think that, you know, that kind of potential overpayment has kind of subsided a little bit more and things are kind of normalizing a little bit in the SPAC market?
It started to subside a little bit. I think, you know, what you've observed in certain circumstances are redemptions or situations where original SPAC investors in the blank check company are seeing the underlying asset post the SPAC acquisition and are saying, no, thank you. You know, I'll take my moderate interest and I will remove myself from the equation. So, you know, I think what you'll continue to see are situations where high quality companies can take the SPAC route, but there has been kind of a culling of, I don't want to say lower quality companies, but there has been a situation where a higher scrutiny has been placed on the underlying asset. And you are more frequently seeing, you know, those blank check investors using redemptions and pulling out in certain circumstances, which again, I think will create a different supply and demand dynamic and will increase the quality bar and perhaps lower the valuation bar going forward.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. It is certainly interesting to watch, especially that you've seen some of these SPACs sort of take material write-downs in order to kind of make the future economics a little bit more palpable for their investor base. Turn this back over a little bit more about Greenspring. You know, JD, I know you and I have talked about this a couple of times in preparation for this, but maybe you could kind of talk about some of the, you know, more competitive advantages and kind of some of the distinct things that Greenspring does relative to other VC investors.
Well, you know, John did a nice job of talking about sort of the platform at the beginning of our discussion today, and we talk a lot, you know, at this firm. And now at our new firm, we talk a lot about the power of the platform and how, you know, one vertical helps drive all others. And our position as a limited partner in funds really helps us get a peek under the hood of what's going on in venture capital markets and source a lot of ideation about what we want to do when it comes to our direct investing and our secondaries investing. You know, going back to the starting of the company 21 years ago, and I was not around, even John wasn't around, although John's one of our longer tenured employees. You know, back then, when folks were bringing venture capital to groups that weren't just endowments and foundations, it was being sold as an access asset class, which it still very much is today. But Ashton Newhall, when he founded our firm and his partners, they decided that it needed to be more than just giving people access to funds. You needed to layer in the direct exposure and layer in the secondary exposure. And that brings us to where we are today, because frankly, if there's one thing that we can all agree on is that, you know, these folks who are leading these funds are some of the smartest investors in the world, and they really are exceptionally good at identifying the companies of tomorrow and the ones that are going to be our household names, you know, in the next few years. And it's happening very quickly. So basically what we're trying to do is use our relationships with these groups to source our ideas and to listen to the market and to really get exposure to some of these category defining companies, because that's at the end of the day, you know, what we're trying to do for our limited partners is get exposure to the best companies. John, I kind of jumped all over the place there. Did I skip anything?
Well, the only other thing I would just add on to is data and information. I mean, what's different about private market investing is access to information is asymmetrical. And we truly believe that those with the ability to collect, analyze, and make sense of the information are going to be the ones in a pole position to, you know, identify the category leaders of tomorrow, as JD was alluding to. And as large investor and venture capital funds, we're privy to some great information. We have the ability to track companies over a long period of time, and we've invested extensively and heavily in our data tracking systems and resources. And one of the great things about, you know, our combination with StepStone is they too share in that belief, and it's been a cornerstone of their platform for a long time. So data is really at the center of this, especially when focusing on those venture-backed companies that are, you know, hopefully demonstrating a lot of traction throughout their kind of growth trajectory.
Yeah. And you know, I guess maybe just one other, you know, kind of natural follow-up to that question, you know, is one, how do you guys evaluate risks as we talk about those kind of companies that are at different points in their life cycle, right? When you kind of play in such a broad spectrum of companies in their maturation, their development, their scalability, how do you sort of evaluate, you know, the return and risk profiles of those different companies?
So, you know, John, please feel free to jump in. But, you know, there's kind of, you know, different as we move up the life cycle, which John talked about a few minutes ago. There's different areas of risk, and you know, you have sort of technology risk, i.e., does the app work? Does the tech work? You know, whatever your product happens to be, it, making sure that that's not a barrier to entry. Is there a product market fit risk? You know, i.e., do people want the product? You know, do people want to buy, you know, dog food online, or do they still like to go down the street to their local store? You know, scaling risk, can you sell a lot of your product? You know, not only is there appetite, but can you really take over the market and distribute it? And oftentimes metrics that we are looking at as an investor, but also the funds in which we're investing at is, are you meeting your sales targets? Are you meeting your distribution targets? And then, you know, when you move past those areas of risk, you have kind of execution risk, which is really like, can we grow the company? Can we execute on our strategic plan for the next few years? And oftentimes what that means is, can we execute on our strategic plan to take over our segment of the market, our market entirely? And then can we execute on the plan to have a liquidity event in the not too distant future? So that's what we think about when we think of the cycle or the phases of risk.
But so you know, a lot of people obviously understand valuation in terms of, you know, market capitalization. And obviously that's not really a metric available to most of you. So when you look at valuations and sort of think about pricing or valuing some of the companies that you own within your portfolios, what's that process? How do you guys think about it? And then, you know, what other, you know, sort of sanity checks do you do to figure out, you know, whether or not the valuation is kind of in the right place?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I you're exactly right, Peter. I mean, it's not as simple as simply saying, okay, you know, this is the post money of the round. Is that reasonable? You know, you need to be looking at a whole host of metrics to have a holistic view on what that means in the context of that particular company. So, you know, we also want to look at the efficiency of revenue growth, which is really important for us. So, you know, how are the incremental dollars being invested in sales and marketing, and what are they spitting out in terms of lifetime value? And to answer your question directly, Peter, it really comes down to precedent that we see, and it comes down to trying to normalize whatever environment we're in with a larger sort of historical period of time so that we are, you know, smoothing over either major valuation upswings or downswings, and we're arriving at something that's more reasonable for a longer period of time. And, you know, for us, one of the things we think about is, you know, we want to reach our returns independent of multiple expansion. In other words, it's great if the public market pays more for a business than, you know, we do on the private side, but we better not be reliant upon them to create the returns that we're looking for. Otherwise, that's, you know, playing an arbitrage, and that is a more speculative territory that we think, you know, is a little less durable than investing in growth and investing in companies that you think, you know, to JD's earlier point, can overcome execution risk, scaling risk, et cetera, to kind of get to the point, you know, where they ultimately need to be at exit.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, and John or JD, correct me where you feel as though I'm off basis here, but just to kind of contextualize that a little bit, right? So when they're discussing multiple expansion, they mean it in analogous terms of the price to earnings ratio remains relatively stable, right? So the dollar that you're paying for earnings in this context is going to remain the same. But the difference is with VC, right? You're dealing a little bit less in terms of actual earnings, and you're dealing with another metric, whether that is price to sales or price to enterprise value, whatever the other multiple is. You want that to stay constant and just kind of have the organic growth of that denominator kind of being the one that's growing the most.
That's right, Peter. And typically for venture-backed companies, it's what we would call a revenue multiple. So it'd be revenue to equity or enterprise value. And my point in saying that is basically, you know, it's great if the public market takes this 6x revenue multiple that you paid and turns that into a 12x. But, you know, what you don't want, or what we don't want, is to be reliant upon that to meet our returns. Our hope is that our companies can execute effectively and can grow their revenue to a point where, even at the same multiple paid for that revenue, we're achieving the return expectations that we hope for. We think that's a healthier position to be in than kind of playing the arbitrage, so to speak.
No, that's great. So just as far as, you know, how Greenspring sort of views the market, you know, certainly there's the broader VC backdrop, which I do want to hit on, but also, you know, what areas or sectors of the markets does Greenspring sort of specialize in? And, you know, does that evolve over time based on the market backdrop and sort of hot sectors, or is it pretty durable and pretty static as far as how you, the areas of the market that you want to play in?
What's pretty cool about Greenspring is that we don't really have like a thematic or thesis approach. And don't get me wrong, there are some specialists that are exceptional in very kind of niche areas that they play in. But JD mentioned this and went into good detail on it. Our kind of real competitive advantage as an organization is the deep relationships that we have with, you know, fund managers that have driven a disproportionate amount of the overall returns of the industry, and the ability to kind of look through those portfolios and pick and choose which companies are kind of growing in an attractive way. So we're much more of, we want exposure to the best assets, irrespective of, you know, their sector, their particular segment. You know, obviously there are certain business models that we've seen be successful in time, But what we don't want to do is back ourselves into a corner and have a very narrow set of opportunities to pursue. So some areas of focus historically have been software businesses, in particular, software as a service companies or cloud companies. We've invested fairly heavily in the e-commerce vertical, the marketplace vertical. We invest in internet infrastructure businesses, more of kind of the plumbing layer of the internet, the healthcare services, healthcare IT, financial technology. And those are probably the largest areas of focus in the context of taking more of a bottoms-up approach as opposed to a tops-down approach.
No, that's great. And then JD, I got a question for you. So, you know, let's say that there's two companies, company A and B, a lot of similar metrics. What are some of the more intangible qualities or characteristics that you guys look for in a company that maybe aren't defined on paper?
Well, you know, I'm not a member of our investment team, so I would typically defer to them on that answer. Having said that, I think, you know, John has done a really nice job of painting the picture, which is that, you know, we do everything based on our relationships. You know, I think everything you see that comes out of Greenspring or now StepStone has the word trusted relationships associated with it. And, you know, it's about building relationships with the general partners, then uncovering the companies that we really want to pursue through those relationships. And then, you know, using our own tools in our tool belt to make ourselves useful to the entrepreneurs running these businesses and the management teams of these businesses, and using those relationships to get to know the business, to get to trust the management, to trust their ability to execute on the strategic plan for the business. So that's what it's, you know, those are the intangibles. I mean, you know, and our, you know, members of our investment team could talk to you for hours about, you know, conversations that they have with management, that they have with other general partners, that they have with the partnerships the partners at our firm, you know, around those different types of things.
I guess what I'm trying to ask, and you know, hopefully this is an area they feel comfortable commenting on, but, you know, at smaller companies, I would imagine the management teams or the executive leadership team probably are more important. Not to say that they're not important at the largest of companies in the world, but I guess does, you know, the management team diligence, you know, play a big factor in investment decisions for Greenspring?
It does, depending on where our entry point is. And well, it really does in all circumstances, but I would say it's the emphasis would be heavier on the intangibles of the management team the earlier that we were investing, to your point, Peter. I mean, as we all know, you know, there's a certain sort of willing it to be the case early on in the life cycle of a company. We were joking earlier about Yield Street being pretty creative in their setup of this recording studio and using the resources that they have to kind of get that set up. There's a certain mentality of figuring it out early on that really comes down to the senior leaders of the business. And so, yeah, we've backed, you know, repeat entrepreneurs early on in their life cycle, folks with experience at larger companies creating strategies and businesses for points of frustration while at those larger companies. So there is a lot of assessment around, is this the right person to execute on the vision for that business? And do they have the expertise and people around them to be successful in doing so? And then as you get later, I don't want to diminish the importance of, you know, really, really excellent management teams, but you're absolutely right. You have product market fit. It's more about proper execution. And sometimes this skill set for execution and scaling is a bit different than, you know, hacking together growth in any way you can early on. So the metrics tend to be, I would say, a little more front and center the later stage you are, you know, in businesses that you're evaluating.
No, that's very helpful. You know, as you guys kind of sit in your seats and, you know, look forward into, you know, sort of how the VC market is evolving and sort of the market backdrop as a whole, you know, how do you see kind of the VC market playing out, let's say, over the course of the next couple of years? And are there any real kind of tectonic shifts that you're kind of expecting, you know, coming to the VC market?
I think accessibility on the investor side. We too really believe in, you know, Yield Street's premise in that there will be greater democratization of alternative investments going forward. We're excited about your guys' vision and mission. And we like the idea of, you know, being an organization that also is aware of that and wants to embrace the fact that, you know, there are some really amazing investment opportunities for qualified clients, qualified purchasers, accredited investors out there. And you know, it's high time that we kick down the barriers to accessing those. And so, you know, from our seats, we're excited about being an organization that embraces that and looking for creative solutions to partner with organizations that embrace that as well.
And then JD, just anything on the market backdrop now for VC as a whole, you know, is there, you know, is money having a harder time being deployed? Are the opportunities pretty robust there for capital that VC firms have raised? Any color on that front?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, just on the backdrop as a whole, you know, anytime, you know, obviously we're now sort of beginning to come out of a period of turmoil with COVID, and hopefully things, you know, trend positively. But anytime you have some sort of period of distress, it spawns innovation. And so I'm sure we'll see companies coming out of this cycle that are incredibly exciting, you know, many of which probably have already started to impact our life in one way or another. As we think about putting dollars to work, yeah, no, it's a really good point. And we touched on it a couple of minutes ago, but, you know, capital is a commodity, not just in venture capital, but in all markets these days. And you really need to be able to differentiate yourself as a source of capital rather than just a blank check. And so whether that means bringing our relationships to the table, introducing customers, introducing senior employees, to John's point just a minute ago, you know, even introducing acquirers or things along those lines along the journey. And sometimes we, as an investor or a prospective investor, in trying to make ourselves appealing to the management team of a company or the entrepreneur or the general partner, you know, we're doing this work just to make ourselves, you know, an appealing investor, if you will, because capital is so commoditized. So you've got to differentiate yourself, and you got to be a lot more than a blank check. Yeah, for sure.
All right. I have one last question for you all. And then I do want to give you a moment for any closing remarks, if you guys have anything that you feel like we should have touched on that we didn't. But, you know, a lot of VC investing, to me at least, appears as though, you know, people are often looking for the unicorn, you know, the 100x type investment opportunity. But I imagine the balance of, you know, returns and performance within most VC portfolios are probably made up by, you know, dozens of smaller companies that, you know, did really well, but maybe just didn't necessarily have the addressable market like a consumer focused company like an Uber, whatever it might be. So I guess my question is just, you know, how do you guys overall think about, you know, a successful company or investment opportunity versus, you know, trying to reach for the one that's going to, you know, change everyone's lives and become, you know, the next $100 billion private company?
There's a lot of ways to skin the cat, so to speak, and every strategy is different. And there certainly are firms that are successful going after the most marquee opportunities, the largest TAMs, et cetera. But there's also something to be said for firms that are sort of focused on maybe underserved geographies, underserved sectors, have an orientation where the fund size is smaller, the ownership percentage is higher. Maybe it's a highly capital efficient business. It doesn't need to raise as much money. So yeah, I mean, I do think it's a little bit of a misnomer that an overwhelming majority of the returns are driven by a handful of companies. That said, it's venture. It's an outliers-driven business. You know, you do need to focus on getting exposure to the best companies because, you know, in most markets, it's true. It is a winner-take-most market, and there will be obvious winners as time passes and as industries become more mature. But again, you know, returns don't necessarily need to be driven by a single company or two companies within a particular fund. If the manager is being thoughtful around portfolio construction, ownership, fund size, and additional dynamics.
No, that's very insightful. All right, John, JD, thank you guys so much for joining today. To listen to other episodes of The Yield, please visit and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. For any questions on Yield Street, please visit www.yieldstreet.com or email us at investments@yieldstreet.com. Thank you both so much today.
Thank you. We really enjoyed it. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.